is still looking at you. It's not as unnerving as it should be.
I tried to ask him. It didn't go well.
Guess, you say, because you know full well there's a reason he asked the gray man in the first place. Hoa's eyes shift down. Your distrust hurts.
He wants to make sure the obelisk gate is never opened again.
The what? Ika asks. But you're leaning your head back against the wall, floored and horrified and wondering. Of course. Alabaster. What easier way to wipe out people who depend on food and sunlight to survive than to simply let this season wear on until they are extinct, leaving nothing but the Stone Eaters to inherit the darkening earth. And to make sure it happens, kill the only person with the power to end it. Only person besides you, you realize with a chill. But no. You can manipulate an obelisk, but you haven't got a clue how to activate 200 of the rusting things at once. And can Alabaster do it anymore? Every use of Orogeny kills him slowly. Flaking rust? You're the only one left who even has the potential to open the gate. But if Gray Man's pet army kills both of you, his purpose is served either way. It means Gray Man wants to wipe out Origins in particular, you say to Yika. You're abbreviating heavily, not lying. That's what you tell yourself. That's what you need to tell Yika, so that she never learns that Origins have the potential power to save the world, and so that she never attempts to access an obelisk herself. This is what Alabaster must have constantly had to do with you. Telling you some of the truth because you deserve it, but not enough that you'll skewer yourself on it. Then you think of another bone you can throw. Hoa was trapped in an obelisk for a while. He said it's the only thing that can stop them. Not the only way, he'd said. But maybe Hoa's giving you only the safe truths, too. Well, shit, Ika says, annoyed. You can do obelisk stuff. Throw one at him. You groan. That wouldn't work. What would then? I have no idea. That's what I've been trying to learn from Alabaster all this time. And failing, you don't want to say. Yika can guess it anyway. Great. Yika abruptly seems to wilt. You are right. I need to sleep. I had Esni mobilize the strongbacks to secure weapons in the comm. Ostensibly, they're making them ready for use if we have to fight off these equatorials. In truth, she shrugs, sighs, and you understand. People are frightened right now. Best not to tempt fate. You can't trust the strongbacks, you say softly. Yika looks up at you. Kastrima isn't wherever you came from. You want to smile, though you don't because you know how ugly the smile will be. You're from so many places. In every one of them you learned that Ragas and Stills can never live together. Yika shifts a little at the look on your face anyway. She tries again. Look, how many other comms would have let me live after learning what I was? You shake your head. You were useful. That worked for the Imperial Origins, too. But being useful to others is not the same thing as being equal. Fine. Then I'm useful. We all are. Kill or exile the Rogas, and we lose Kastrima Anda. Then we're at the mercy of a bunch of people who would as soon treat all of us like Rogas, just because our ancestors couldn't pick a race and stick to it. You keep saying, we, you say. It is gentle. It bothers you to puncture her illusions. She stops, and a muscle in her jaw flexes once or twice. Stills learned to hate us. They can learn differently. Now? With an enemy literally at the gate? You're so tired. So tired of all this shit. Now is when we'll see the worst of them. Ika watches you for a long moment. Then she slumps completely, her back bowing and her head hanging, and her ash-blow hair sliding off to the sides of her neck until it looks utterly ridiculous, a butterfly mane. It hides her face. But she draws in a long, weary breath, and it sounds almost like a sob. Or a laugh.
No, Essen. She rubs her face.
Just no.
Kastrima is my home, same as theirs. I've worked for it, fought for it. Kastrima wouldn't be here if not for me. And probably some of the other Roggers who risked themselves to keep it all going over the years. I'm not giving up.
It isn't giving up to look out for yourself.
Yes, it is.
She lifts her head. It wasn't a sob or a laugh. She's furious, just not at you.
You're saying these people, my parents, my creche teachers, my friends, my lovers, you're saying just leave them to their fate. You're saying they're nothing, that they're not people at all, just beasts whose nature it is to kill. You're saying Roggers are nothing but prey, and that's all we'll ever be. No, I won't accept that.
She sounds so determined. It makes your heart ache, because you felt the same way she did once. It would be nice to still feel that way, to have some hope of a real future, a real community, a real life. But you have lost 3 children relying on Still's better nature. You grab the runny sack and get up to leave, rubbing a hand over your locks. Hoa vanishes, reading your cue that the conversation is over. Later, then. When you're almost at the curtain, though, Ika stops you with what she says.
Pass the word around, she tells you. The emotion is gone from her voice. No matter what happens, we can't start anything.
Loaded into that delicate emphasis is an acknowledgement that origins are the we she means this time.
We shouldn't even finish it. Fighting back could set off a mob. Only talk to the others in small groups, person to person's best if you can, so no one thinks we're getting together to conspire. Make sure the children know all this. Make sure none of them are ever alone.
Most of the Orogen children do know how to defend themselves. The techniques you taught them work just as well for deterring or stopping attackers as for icing boil bug nests. But Yika's right. There are too few of you to fight back, not without destroying Kastrima, a Pyrrhic victory. It means that some Orogens are going to die. You're going to let them die, even if you could save them. And you did not think Ika cold enough to think this way. Your surprise must show on your face. Ika smiles.
I have hope, she says. But I'm not stupid. If you're right and things get hopeless, then we don't go without a fight. We make them regret turning on us. But up to that point of no return. I hope you're not right.
You know you're right. The belief that Orogens will never be anything but the world's meat dances amid the cells of you, like magic. It isn't fair. You just want your life to matter. But you say, I hope I'm not right too.
The dead have no wishes. Tablet 3, Structures, Verse 6.
17. Nasun. Verses. It has been so long since Nasun was proud of herself that when she becomes capable of healing Shafa, she runs all the way through town and up to Found Moon to tell him. Healing is how she thinks of it. She has spent the past few days out in the forest practicing her new skill. It is not always easy to detect the wrongness in a body. Sometimes she must carefully follow the threads of silver within a thing to find its knots and warps. The ash falls have grown more frequent and sustained lately, and most of the forest is patchy with grayness, some plants beginning to wilt or go dormant in response. This is normal for them, and the silver threads prove this by their uninterrupted flow. Yet when Nasun goes slowly, looks carefully, she can usually find things for which change is not normal or healthy. The grub beneath a rock that has a strange growth along its side. The snake, venomous and more vicious now that a season has begun, so she only examines it from a distance, with a broken vertebra. The melon vine, whose leaves are growing in a convex shape, catching too much ash, instead of concavity, which would shake the ash off. The few ants in a nest who have been infected by a parasitic fungus. She practices extraction of the wrongness on these things and many others. It's a difficult trick to master, like performing surgery using only thread, without ever touching the patient. She learns how to make the edge of one thread grow very sharp, and how to loop and lasso with another, and how to truncate a third thread and use the burning tip of it to cauterize. She gets the growth off the grub, but it dies. She stitches together the edges of broken bone within the snake, though this only speeds what was happening already naturally. She finds the parts of the plant that are saying curve up and convinces them to say curve down. The ants are best. She cannot get all or even most of the fungus out of them, but she can sear the connections in their brains that make them behave strangely and spread the infection. She's very, very glad to have brains to work on. The culmination of Nasun's practice occurs when calmless raiders strike again, one morning as dew still dampens the ash and ground litter. The band that Shafa devastated is gone. These are new miscreants who don't know the danger. Nasun is not distracted by her father anymore, not helpless anymore, and after she ices one of the raiders, most of the others flee. But she detects a snarl of threads in one of them at the last instant, and then must resort to old-style orogeny, as she has come to think of it, in order to drop the ground beneath the raider and trap her in a pit. The raider throws a knife at Nasun when she peeks over the edge. It's only luck that it misses, but carefully, while staying out of sight. Nasun follows the threads and finds a 3-inch wooden splinter lodged in the woman's hand, so deep that it scrapes bone. It is poisoning her blood and will kill her. Already the infection is so advanced that it has swollen her hand to twice its size. A calm doctor, or even a decent farrier, could extract the thing. But the calmless do not have the luxury of skilled care. They live on luck, what little there is in a season. Nasun decides to become the woman's luck. She settles nearby so that she can concentrate, and then carefully, while the woman gasps and swears and cries, "What is happening?" she pulls the splinter free. When she looks into the pit again, the woman is on her knees and groaning as she holds her dripping hand. Belatedly, Nasun realizes she will need to learn how to anesthetize, so she settles against the tree again and casts her thread to try to catch a nerve this time. It takes her some time to learn how to numb it and not just cause more pain. But she learns, and when she is done, she feels grateful to the raider woman who lies groaning and in a stupor in the pit. Nasun knows better than to let the woman go. If she lives, she will only either die slowly and cruelly, or return and perhaps next time threaten someone Nasun loves. So Nasun casts her threads one last time, and this time slices neatly through the top of her spine. It is painless, and kinder than the fate the woman intended for Nasun. Now she runs up the hill toward Found Moon, elated for the first time since she killed Aits, so eager to see Shafa that she barely notices the other children of the compound as they stop whatever they're doing and favor her with cool stares. Shafa has explained to them that what she did to Aits was an accident, and he has assured her they will eventually come around. She hopes he is right, because she misses their friendship. But none of that is important now. Shafa! She first pokes her head into the guardian's cabin. Only Nita is there, standing in the corner as she so often does, staring into the middle distance as if lost in thought. She focuses as soon as Nasun comes in, however, and smiles in her empty way. Hello, Shafa's little one, she says. You seem cheerful today. Hello, guardian. She's always polite to Nita and Umber. Just because they want to kill her is no reason to forget her manners. Do you know where Shafa is? He's in the crucible with Wude. Okay, thanks. Nasun hurries off undeterred. She knows that Wude, as the next most skilled with eights gone, is the only other child in Found Moon who has some hope of connecting to an obelisk. Nasun thinks it is hopeless, because no one can train him in the way he needs to be trained, given that he is so small and frail. Wude would never have survived Mama's crucibles. Still, she is polite to him, too, running up to the edge of the outermost practice circle and bouncing only a little, keeping her orogeny still, so as not to distract him while he raises a big basalt column from the ground and then tries to push it back in. He's already breathing hard, though the column isn't moving very fast. Shafa is watching him intently, his smile not as big as usual. Shafa sees it too. Finally, Wude gets the column back into the ground. Shafa takes his shoulder and helps him over to a bench, which is plainly necessary because Wude can barely walk at this point. Shafa glances at Nasun, and Nasun nods at once and turns to run back into the mess hall to fetch a glass from the pitcher of fruit water there. When she brings it to Wude, he blinks at her once, then looks ashamed of hesitating, and finally takes it with a shy nod of thanks. Shafa is always right.
Do you need help back to the dormitory? Shafa asks him.
I can make it back myself, sir, Wude says. His eyes dart to Nasun, by which Nasun understands that Wude probably would like help back, but knows better than to get in between Shafa and his favorite student. Nasun looks at Shafa. She's excited, but she can wait. He lifts an eyebrow, then inclines his head and extends a hand to help Wude up. Once Wude is safely abed, Shafa comes back over to where Nasun now sits on the bench. She's calmer for the delay, which is good, because she knows she's going to need to seem calm and cool and professional in order to convince him to let some half-grown, half-trained girl experiment on him with magic. Shafa sits down beside her, looking amused.
All right, then.
She takes a deep breath before beginning. I know how to take the thing out of you. They both know exactly what she's talking about. She has sat beside Shafa, quietly offering herself as he has huddled on this very bench, clutching his head and whispering replies to a voice she cannot hear, and shuddering as it punishes him with lashes of silver pain. Even now it is a low, angry throb inside him, pushing him to obey, to kill her. She makes herself available, because her presence eases the pain for him, and because she does not believe he will actually kill her. This is folly, she knows. Love is no inoculation against murder, but she needs to believe it of him. Shafa frowns at her, and it is part of why she loves him that he shows no sign of disbelief.
Yes, I have sensed you growing sharper lately, by increments. This happened to the origins at the Fulcrum too. When they were allowed to progress to this point, they become their own teachers. The power guides them along particular paths, by lines of natural aptitude.
His brow furrows slightly.
Generally we steered them away from this path, though.
Why?
Because it's dangerous. To everyone, not just the origin in question.
He leans against her, shoulder warm and supportive.
You've survived the point that kills most, connecting with an obelisk. Aye. Remember how others died, making the attempt.
For a moment he looks troubled, lost, confused, as he probes gingerly at the raw edges of his torn memories.
I remember something of it.
I'm glad. He winces again, looks troubled again. This time it isn't the silver that's hurting him. Nasun guesses he's either remembered something he dislikes or can't remember something he thinks he should. She won't be able to take the pain of loss away from him, no matter how good she gets. It's sobering. She can remove the rest of his pain, though, and that's the part that matters. She touches his hand, her fingers covering the thin scars that she has seen him inflict with his own nails when the pain grows too great, even for his smiles to ease. There are more of them today than there were a few days ago, some still raw. I didn't die, she reminds him. He blinks, and this alone is enough to snap him back into the here and now of himself.
No, you didn't. But Nasun.
He adjusts their hands. Now he is holding hers. His hand is huge, and she can't even see a glimpse of her own within it. She has always liked this, being enveloped so completely by him.
My compassionate one. I do not want my core stone removed.
Core stone. Now she knows the name of her nemesis. The word makes no sense because it is metal, not stone, and it is not at the core of him, just in his head. But that doesn't matter. She clenches her jaw against hate.
It hurts you. As it should. I have betrayed it.
His jaw tightens briefly.
But I accepted the consequences of doing so, Nasun. I can bear them.
This makes no sense. It hurts you. I could stop the hurt. I can even make it stop hurting without taking it out, but only for a little while. I'd have to stay with you. She learned this from that conversation with Steel, and watching what the Stone Eater did. Stone Eaters are full of magic, so much more than people, but Nasun can approximate. But if I take it out...
If you take it out, Shafa says, I will no longer be a guardian. Do you know what that means, Nasun?
It means that then Shafa can be her father. He is in every way that matters already. Nasun does not think this in so many words because there are things she is not yet prepared to confront about herself or her life. This will change very soon. But it is in her mind.
It means that I will lose much of my strength and health,
he says in reply to her silent wishing.
I will no longer be able to protect you, my little one.
His eyes flick toward the guardian's cabin. And she understands then. Umber and Nida will kill her. They will try, she thinks. His head tilts. Of course, he is instantly aware of her defiant intent.
You couldn't defeat them both, Nasun. Even you aren't that powerful. They have tricks you haven't yet seen. Skills that...
He looks troubled again.
I don't want to remember what they are capable of doing to you.
Nasun tries not to let her bottom lip poke out. Her mother always said that was pouting, and that pouting and whining were things only babies did. You shouldn't say no because of me. She could take care of herself.
I'm not. I mentioned that only in hopes that the urge for self-preservation will help convince you. But for my own part, I do not want to grow weak and ill and die, Nasun, which is what would happen if you took the stone. I am older than you realize.
The blurry look returns for a moment. By this, she knows he does not remember how old.
Older than I realize. Without the core stone to stop it, that time will catch up with me. A handful of months and I'll be an old man, trading the pain of the stone for the pains of old age. And then I'll die.
You don't know that. She's shaking a little, Her throat hurts.
I do. I've seen it happen, little one. And it is a cruelty, not a kindness when it does.
Shafa's eyes have narrowed, as if he must strain to see the memory. Then he focuses on her.
My Nasun, have I hurt you so?
Nasun bursts into tears. She's not really sure why, except maybe because she's been wanting this, working toward it so much. She's wanted to do something good with Orogeny when she has used it to do so many terrible things already. And she wanted to do it for him. He's the only person in the world who understands her, loves her for what she is, protects her despite what she is. Shafa sighs and pulls Nasun into his lap, where she wraps herself around him and blubbers into his shoulder for a long while, heedless of the fact that they are out in the open. When the weeping has spent itself, though, she realizes that he is holding her just as tightly. The silver is alive and searing within him because she's so close. His fingertips are on the back of her neck, and it would be so easy for him to push in, destroy her Sesapine, kill her with a single thrust. He hasn't. He's been fighting the urge all this while. He would rather suffer this, risk this, than let her help him. And that is the worst thing in all the world. She sets her jaw and clenches her hands on the back of his shirt. Dance along the silver. Flow with it. The sapphire is nearby. If she can make both flow together, it will be quick. A precise surgical yank. Shafa tenses. Nasun. The blaze of silver within him suddenly goes still and dims slightly. It is as if the core stone is aware of the threat she poses. It is for his own good, but... She swallows. If she hurts him because she loves him, is that still hurt? If she hurts him a lot now so that he will hurt less later, does that make her a terrible person?
Nasun, please.
Is that not how love should work? But this thought makes her remember her mother, and a chilly afternoon with clouds obscuring the sun and a brisk wind making her shake as Mama's fingers covered hers and held her hand down on a flat rock. If you can control yourself through pain, I'll know you're safe. She lets go of Shafa and sits back, chilled by who she has almost become. He sits still for a moment longer, perhaps in relief or regret. Then he says quietly,
You've been gone all day. Have you eaten?
Nasun is hungry, but she doesn't want to admit it. All of a sudden she feels the need of distance between them, something that will help her love him less, so that the urge to help him against his will does not ache so within her. She says, looking at her hands, I want to go see Daddy. Shafa is silent a moment longer. He disapproves. She doesn't need to see or cess to know this. By now, Nasun has heard of what else transpired on the day that she killed Aits. No one heard what Shafa said to Jija, but many people saw him knock Jija down, crouch over him, and grin into his face while Jija stared back with wide, frightened eyes. She can guess why it happened. For the first time, however, Nasun tries not to care about Shafa's feelings.
Shall I come with you? He asks.
No. She knows how to handle her father, and she knows that Shafa has no patience for him. I'll be back right after.
See that you are, Nasun.
It sounds kindly.
It's a warning.
But she knows how to handle Shafa, too. Yes, Shafa. She looks up at him. Don't be afraid. I'm strong, like you made me.
As you made yourself.
His gaze is soft and terrible. Ice-white eyes can't be anything but, though there's love layered over the terrible. Nasun is used to the combination by now. So Nasun climbs out of his lap. She's tired, even though she hasn't done anything. Emotion always makes her tired, but she heads down the hill into Jekity, nodding to people she knows, whether they nod back or not, noticing the new granary the village is building, since they've had time to increase their stores while the ash falls and sky occlusions are still intermittent. It's an ordinary quiet day in this ordinary quiet calm, and in some ways it feels much like Terimo. If not for Found Moon and Shafa, Nasun would hate it here the same way. She may never understand why, if Mama had the whole of the world open to her after somehow escaping her fulcrum. She chose to live in such a placid backwater place. Thus it is with her mother on her mind that Nasun knocks on the door of her father's house. She has a room here, but it isn't her house. This is why she knocks. Jija opens the door almost immediately, as if he was about to leave and go somewhere, or as if he has been waiting for her. The scent of something redolent with garlic wafts out of the house, from the little hearth near the back. Nasun thinks maybe it is fish in a pot, since the Jekity calm shares have a lot of fish and vegetables in them. It's the first time Jija has seen her in a month, and his eyes widen for a moment. "Hi, Daddy," she says. It's awkward. Jija bends, and before Nasun quite knows what's happening, he's picked her up and swept her into an embrace. Jekity feels like Terimo, but in a good way now. Like back when Mama was around, but Daddy was the one who loved her most, and the stuff on the stove would be duck in a pot instead of fish. If this were then, Mama would be yelling at the neighbor's kikuza pup for stealing cabbages from their house green. Old Lady Tucka never did tie the creature up the way she should. The air would smell like it does now. Rich cooking food mingled with the more acrid scents of freshly chipped rock and the chemicals Daddy uses to soften and smooth his nappings. Uche would be running around in the backyard making whoosh sounds and yelling that he was falling as he tried to jump up in the air. Nasun stiffens in Jija's embrace as she suddenly realizes. Uche, jumping up, falling up, or pretending to. Uche, whom Daddy beat to death. Jija feels her tense, and tenses as well. Slowly he lets go of her, easing her to the ground, as the joy in his expression fades to unease. Nasun, he says. His gaze searches her face.
Are you all right?
I'm okay, Daddy. She misses his arms around her. She can't help that. But the epiphany about Uche has reminded her to be careful. I just wanted to see you. Some of the unease in Jija fades a little. He hesitates, seems to fumble for something to say, then finally stands aside.
Come in. Are you hungry? There's enough for you, too.
So she heads inside and they sit down to eat, and he fusses over how long her hair has gotten and how nice the cornrows and puffs look. Did she do them herself, and is she a little taller? She might be, she acknowledges with a blush, even though she knows for certain that she is a whole inch taller than the last time Jija measured her. Shafa checked one day, because he thought he might need to requisition some new clothes with Found Moon's next calm share. She's such a big girl now, Jija says, and there is such real pride in his voice that it disarms her defenses. Almost 11 and so beautiful, so strong, so much like... He falters. Nasun looks down at her plate because he's almost said, so much like your mother. Is this not how love should work? It's okay, Daddy, Nasun makes herself say. It is a terrible thing that Nasun is beautiful and strong like her mother. But love always comes bound in terrible things. I miss her too, because she does, in spite of everything. Jija stiffens slightly, and a muscle along the curve of his jaw flexes a little.
I don't miss her, sweetening.
This is so obviously a lie that Nasun stares and forgets to pretend to argue with him. Forgets lots of things, apparently. including common sense, because she blurts, "But you do. You miss Uche too, I can tell."
Chicha goes rigid, and he stares at her in something that falls between shock that she would say this out loud and horror at what she has said. And then, as Nasun has come to understand is normal for her father, the shock of the unexpected abruptly transforms into anger.
"Is that what they're teaching you up in that place?" he asks suddenly. "To disrespect your father?"
Suddenly, Nasun is more tired. So very tired of trying to dance around his senselessness. "I wasn't disrespecting you," she says. She tries to keep her voice even, inflectionless, but she can hear the frustration there. She can't help it.
"I was just saying the truth, Daddy. But I don't mind that you..."
"It isn't the truth. It's an insult. I don't like that kind of language, young lady."
Now she's confused. "What kind of language? I didn't say anything bad."
"Calling someone a Raga lover is bad."
"I didn't say that."
But in a way, she did. If Chicha misses Mama and Uche, then that means he loves them, and that makes him a Raga lover. But I'm a Raga. She knows better than to say this, but she wants to. Chicha opens his mouth to retort, then seems to catch himself. He looks away, propping his elbows on the table and steepling his hands in a way he so often does when he's trying to rein in his temper.
"Ragas," he says, and the word sounds like filth in his mouth. "Lie, sweetening. They threaten and manipulate and use. They're evil, Nasun. As evil as Father Earth himself. You aren't like that."
That's a lie, too. Nasun has done what she had to do to survive, including lying and murder. She's done some of these things in order to survive him. She hates that she's had to, and is exasperated by the fact that he apparently never realized it. That she's doing it now and he doesn't see.
"Why do I even love him anymore?"
Nasun finds herself thinking as she stares at her father. Instead, she says,
"Why do you hate us so much, Daddy?"
Chicha flinches, perhaps at her casual us.
"I don't hate you."
"You hate Mama, though. You must have hated U-"
"I did not!"
Chicha pushes back from the table and stands. Nasun flinches despite herself, but he turns away and starts to pace in short, vicious half-circles around the room.
I know what they're capable of, sweetening. You wouldn't understand. I needed to protect you."
In a sudden blur of understanding as powerful as magic, Nasun realizes Chicha does not remember standing over Uche's body, his shoulders and chest heaving, his teeth clenched around the words, "Are you one too?" Now he believes he has never threatened her, never shoved her off a wagon seat and down a hill of sticks and stones. Something has rewritten the story of his origin children in Chicha's head. A story that is as chiseled and unchangeable as stone in Nasun's mind. It is perhaps the same thing that has rewritten Nasun for him as daughter and not Raga. As if the two can be fissioned from each other somehow.
"I learned about them when I was a boy, younger than you."
Chicha's not looking at her anymore, gesticulating as he talks and paces.
"Makenba's cousin."
Nasun blinks. She remembers Miss Makenba, the quiet old lady who always smelled like tea. Lerna, the town doctor, was her son. Miss Makenba had a cousin in town? Then Nasun gets it.
"I found him behind the spade seed silo one day. He was squatting there, shaking. I thought he was sick."
Chicha's shaking his head the whole time, still pacing.
"There was another boy with me. We always used to play together, the three of us. Curl went to shake Lidisk, and Lidisk just..."
Chicha stops abruptly. He's baring his teeth. His shoulders are heaving the same way they were on that day.
"Curl was screaming, and Lidisk was saying he couldn't stop. He didn't know how. The ice ate up Curl's arm, and his arm broke off.
The blood was in chunks on the ground. Lidisk said he was sorry. He even cried, but he just kept freezing, Curl. He wouldn't stop. By the time I ran away, Curl was reaching for me, and the only thing left of him that wasn't frozen was his head and his chest and that arm. It was too late, though. I knew that. It was too late even before I ran away to get help. It does not comfort Nasun to know that there is a reason, a specific reason for what her father has done. All she can think is, Uche never lost control like that. Mama wouldn't have let him. It's true. Mama had been able to sense and still Nasun's orogeny from all the way across town sometimes. Which means Uche didn't do anything to provoke Jija. Jija killed his own son for what a completely different person did long before that son's birth. This, more than anything, helps her finally understand that there is no reasoning with her father's hatred. So Nasun is almost prepared when Jija's gaze suddenly shifts to her, sidelong and suspicious. Why haven't you cured yourself yet? No reasoning, but she tries, because once upon a time, this man was her whole world. I might be able to soon. I learned how to make things happen with the silver, and how to take things out of people. I don't know how orogeny works or where it comes from, but if it's something that can be taken out, then none of the other monsters in that camp have cured themselves. I've asked around. Jija's pacing has gotten noticeably faster. They go up there and they don't get better. They live there with those guardians, more of them every day, and none of them have been cured. Was it a lie? It isn't a lie. If I get good enough, I'll be able to do it. She understands this instinctively. With enough fine control and the sapphire obelisk's aid, she will be able to do almost anything, but why aren't you good enough now? We've been here almost a year. Because this is hard, she wants to say. But she realizes he does not want to hear it. He does not want to know that the only way to use orogeny and magic to transform a thing is to become an expert in the use of orogeny and magic. She doesn't answer because there's no point. She cannot say what he wants to hear. It isn't fair that he calls Orogens liars and then demands that she lie. He stops and rounds on her, instantly suspicious of her silence. You aren't trying to get better, are you? Tell the truth, Nasun. She is so rusting tired. I am trying to get better, Daddy, Nasun replies at last. I'm trying to become a better Orogen. Jija steps back, as if she has hit him. That isn't why I let you live up there. He isn't letting anything. Shafa made him. He's even lying to himself now. But it is the lies he's telling her, as he has been, Nasun understands suddenly her whole life, that really break her heart. He said that he loved her after all, but that obviously isn't true. He cannot love an Orogen, and that is what she is. He cannot be an Orogen's father, and that is why he constantly demands she be something other than what she is. And she is tired. Tired and done. I like being an Orogen, Daddy, she says. His eyes widen. This is a terrible thing that she is saying. It is a terrible thing that she loves herself. I like making things move, and doing the silver, and falling into the obelisks. I don't like... She's about to say that she hates what she did to Aates, and she especially hates the way that others treat her now that they know what she is capable of. But she doesn't get the chance. Jija takes two swift steps forward, and the back of his hand swings so fast that she doesn't even see it before it has knocked her out of the chair. It's like that day on the Imperial Road, when she suddenly found herself at the bottom of a hill in pain. It must have been like this for Uche, she realizes, in another swift epiphany. The world as it should be one moment, and completely wrong, completely broken an instant later. At least Uche didn't have time to hate, she thinks in sorrow. And then she ices the entire house. It isn't a reflex. She's intentional about it, precise, shaping the torus to fit the dimensions of the house exactly. No one past the walls will be caught in it. She shapes twin cores out of the torus, too, and centers each on herself and her father. She feels cold along the hairs of her skin, the tug of lowered air pressure on her clothing and plaited hair. Jija feels the same thing, and he screams, his eyes wide and wild and sightless. The memory of a boy's cruel, icy death is in his face. By the time Nasun gets to her feet, staring at her father across a floor slick with plates of solid ice and around the fallen-over chair that is now too warped to ever use again, Jija has stumbled back, slipped on the ice, fallen, and slid partially across the floor to bump against the table legs. There's no danger. Nasun only manifested the torus for an instant as a warning against further violence on his part. Jija keeps screaming, though, as Nasun gazes down at her huddled, panicking father. Perhaps she should feel pity or regret. What she actually feels, however, is cold fury toward her mother. She knows it's irrational. It is no one's fault except Jija's that Jija is too afraid of origins to love his own children. Once, however, Nasun could love her father without qualification. Now, she needs someone to blame for the loss of that perfect love. She knows her mother can bear it. You should have had us with someone stronger, she thinks at Esun, wherever she is. It takes care to walk across the slick floor without slipping, and Nasun has to jiggle the latch for a few seconds to scrape it open. By the time she does, Jija has stopped screaming behind her, though she can still hear him breathing hard and uttering a little moan with every exhalation. She doesn't want to look back at him. She makes herself do it anyway, though, because she wants to be a good origin, and good origins cannot afford self-deception. Jija jerks as if her gaze has the power to burn. "Bye, Daddy," she says. He does not reply in words. And the last tear she shed, as he burned her alive with ice, broke like the shattering upon the ground. Stone your heart against Ragas, for there is nothing but rust in their souls. From Lorist Tale Ice Kisses, recorded in Bebek Kortent, Msida Theater, by Woz Lorist Bebek. Note: a letter signed by 7 equatorial itinerant lorists disavows Woz as a pop lorist hack. Tale may be apocryphal. 18. You counting down. When the sun-said woman is gone, I pull you aside, figuratively speaking. The one you call Grey Man doesn't want to prevent the opening of the gate, I say. I lied. You're so wary of me now. It troubles you, I can see. You want to trust me, even as your very eyes remind you of how I've deceived you. But you sigh and say, yeah, I thought there might be more to it. He'll kill you because you can't be manipulated, I say, ignoring the irony. Because if you opened the gate, you would restore the moon and end the seasons. What he really wants is someone who will open the gate for his purposes. You understand the players now, if not the totality of the game. You frown. So which purpose would that be? Transformation? Status quo? I don't know. Does it matter? Suppose not. You rub a hand over your locks, which you've retwisted recently. I guess that's why he's trying to get Kostrima to kick out all its ragas. Yes. He'll find a way to make you do what he wants, Esun, if he can. If he can't,
You're no use to him. Worse, you're the enemy.
You sigh with the weariness of the earth, and do not reply other than to nod and walk away. I'm so afraid as I watch you leave.
As you have in other moments of despair, you go to Alabaster. There's not much left of him anymore. Since he gave up his legs, he spends his days in a drugged stupor, tucked up against antimony like a pup nursing its mother. Sometimes you don't ask for lessons when you come to see him. That's a waste, because you're pretty sure the only reason he's forced himself to keep living is so that he can pass on the art of global destruction to you. He's caught you at it a few times. You've woken up, curled next to his nest, to find him gazing down at you. He doesn't chide you for it. Probably doesn't have the strength to chide. You're grateful. He's awake now as you settle beside him, though he doesn't move much. Antimony has moved fully into the nest with him these days, and you rarely see her in any pose other than living chair for him, kneeling, legs spread, her hands braced on her thighs. Alabaster rests against her front, which is only possible now because perversely, the few burns on his back healed even as his legs rotted. Fortunately, she has no breasts to make the position less comfortable, and apparently her simulated clothing isn't sharp or rough. Alabaster's eyes shift to follow you as you sit, like a stone eater's. You hate that this comparison occurs to you.
"It's happening again," you say. You don't bother to explain the it. He always knows.
"How did you?"
"At Mayoff."
"You tried. How?"
"Because you can't find it in yourself anymore to bother fighting for this place or building a life here. All your instincts say to grab your runny sack, grab your people, and run before Kastrema turns against you. That's a probable death sentence, the season having well and truly set in topside. But staying seems more certain." He draws in a deep, slow breath, so you know he means to answer. It just takes him a while to muster the words.
"Didn't mean to. You were pregnant. I was lonely. I thought it would do. For a while."
You shake your head. "Of course he knew you were pregnant before you did. That's all irrelevant now.
You fought for them."
It takes effort to emphasize the last word, but you do. For you and Corundum and In and Shore, but he fought for Mayoff too.
"They would have turned on us too one day. You know they would have.
When Corundum proved too powerful, or if they'd managed to drive off the Guardians only to have to leave Mayoff and move elsewhere, it was inevitable." He makes an affirmative sound.
"Then why?"
He lets out a long, slow sigh.
"There was a chance they wouldn't."
You shake your head. The words are so impossible to believe that they sound like gibberish, but he adds,
"Any chance was worth trying."
He does not say for you, but you feel it. It is a subtext that is nearly sensible beneath the word's surface. So your family could have a normal life among other people as one of them. Normal opportunities, normal struggles. You stare at him. On impulse, you lift your hand to his face, drawing fingers over his scarred lips. He watches you do this and offers you that little quarter smile, which is all he can muster these days. It's more than you need. Then you get up and head out to try to salvage Kastrema's thin, cracked nothing of a chance. Ika has called a vote for the next morning, 24 hours after Renanus's offer. Kastrema needs to deliver some kind of response, but she doesn't think it should be up to only her informal council. You can't see what difference the vote will make, except to emphasize that if the comm gets through the night intact, it will be a rusting miracle. People look at you as you walk through the comm. You keep your gaze ahead and try not to let them visibly affect you. In brief private visits,
You pass Yika's orders on to Cutter and Temel, and tell them to spread the word. Temel usually takes the kids out for lessons anyway. He says he'll visit his students at home and encourage them to form study groups of 2 and 3 in the homes of trusted adults. You want to say, no adults are trustworthy, but he knows that. There's no way around it, so it's pointless to say aloud. Cutter says he'll pass on the word to the few other adult ragas. Not all of them have the skill to throw a torus or control themselves well. Except for you and Alabaster, they're all ferals. But Cutter will make sure. The ones who can't stick near those who can. His face is impassive as he adds, and who'll watch your back? Which means he's offering. The revulsion that shivers through you at this idea is surprising. You've never really trusted him, though you don't understand why. Something about the fact that he's hidden all his life, which is hypocritical as hell after your 10 years in Terimo. But then, sweet flaking rust, do you trust anyone? As long as he does his job, it doesn't matter. You force yourself to nod. Come find me after you're done, then. He agrees. With that, you decide to get some rest yourself. Your bedroom is wrecked thanks to Hoa's transformation, and you're not much interested in sleeping in Tonki's bed. It's been months, but the memory of mildew dies hard. Also, you've realized, belatedly, that there's no one to watch Yika's back. She believes in her calm, but you don't. Hoa ate Ruby Hair, who at least had an assumable interest in keeping her alive. So you borrow another pack from Temel and scrounge your apartment for a few basic supplies, not quite a runny sack. There's plausible deniability if Yika protests, and then head to her apartment. This will have the added purpose of making it hard for Cutter to find you. She's still asleep, from the sound of her breathing through the bedroom curtain. Her divans are pretty comfortable, especially compared to sleeping rough when you were on the road. You use your running sack for a pillow and curl up, trying to forget the world for a while. And then you wake when Yika curses and stumbles past you at full speed, half ripping down one of the apartment curtains in her haste. You struggle awake and sit up. What? But by then you too hear the rising shouts outside, angry shouts, a crowd, gathering. So it's begun. You get up and follow, and it's not an afterthought that you grab the packs. The knot of people is gathered on the ground level, near the communal baths. Yika scrambles to that level in ways you will not, sliding down metal ladders, hopping over the railing of one platform to swing down to the one she knows is below, running across bridges that sway alarmingly beneath her feet. You go down in the sensible, non-suicidal way, so by the time you get to the knot of people, Yika is in full shout, trying to get everyone to shut up and listen and back the fuck off. At the center of the knot is Cutter, clad in nothing but a towel, for once looking something other than indifferent. Now he's tense, jaw set, defiant, braced to flee. And 5 feet away, the iced corpse of a man sits on the ground, frozen in mid-scrabble backward, a look of abject terror permanently on his face. You don't recognize him, that doesn't matter. What matters is that Araga has killed Astil. This is a match thrown right into the middle of a calm that is dried out, oil-soaked kindling. How this happened, Yika is shouting as you reach the knot of people. You can barely see her. There are nearly 50 people here already. You could push to the front, but you decide to hang back instead. Now is not the time to call attention to yourself. You look around and see Lerna also lurking at the rear of the crowd. His eyes are wide and his jaw tight as he looks back at you. There's also, oh, burning earth, a cluster of 3 Raka kids here. One of them is Penti, who you know is the ringleader of some of the braver, stupider Raka children. She's standing on tiptoe, craning her neck for a better look. When she tries to push forward through the crowd, you catch her eye and give her a mother look. She flinches and subsides at once.
Who the rust cares how it happened?
That's Sekim, one of the innovators. You only know him because Tonki constantly complains that he's too stupid to rightly be part of the cast and should instead be dumped into something